Well, thanks for coming in, Chuck. We really needed your help as a consultant to help us find our next main stage production for the season. We're having a lot of trouble because of some pushback from audiences, and I don't know, I really need your help. So what do you think would be a good fit for us?
How about a classic Shakespeare play, like Taming of the Shrew?
Should we really be using a term like shrew now? It's the Me Too movement. We're in the middle of that.
All right, that's fair. How about Death of a Salesman?
Salesman? Why is it always about the men, Chuck?
All right. I guess you don't like Glengarry Glen Ross?
Well, maybe if it were Gwendolyn Gary and Gwendolyn Ross, be more open-minded.
All right. Here's one with a strong female lead.
Okay.
Romeo and Juliet.
Any reason why it's not Juliet and Romeo? Hey, I'm just telling you what audiences might think, okay?
Driving Miss Daisy.
Why should we assume that Daisy is incapable of driving herself? Is her skirt getting caught up in the gear shift? Maybe she can't adjust her rearview mirror because of her corset.
She doesn't wear a corset.
Well, it doesn't matter anyway. Driving is not very environmentally friendly. We're heading toward a carless future, Chuck.
All right. Okay, you can't say no to this one. Okay?
All right.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
What would PETA say?
All right. Big guns. Ready?
Yep.
Tennessee Williams, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Are you not listening? PETA, do you want the cat to burn on the roof? Also, what about the dog people? Are you just going to exclude them?
No. All right, Footloose.
It seems a little ableist.
Our town?
Our town? It sounds exclusive and fearful of the other.
Godspell?
Hey, listen, I know everybody liked Jesus Christ Superstar last night, but we have to keep the atheists in mind.
So you're saying everything can be offensive to everyone?
Well, I don't think that's it exactly, but I think we should re-examine everything in this new lens. There has to be room for improvement. I just think we need to make some values choices.
So what's left?
We need something that's really family-friendly, down-to-earth.
What cannot offend anyone?
Coming to you live from the Hollywood Bowl in Hollywood, California, it's a Prairie Home Companion.
I'm Evan Dawson. Our thanks to Megan Mack and Juan Vazquez for producing a wonderful introduction to our program this hour. You would have thought until recently on that last. I'm not even going to say anything about how we closed that their piece. Thank you, Megan and Juan, for that. And food for thought there. Can we be offended by everything? Is it appropriate to re-examine everything that we've consumed in the past in the way of art, especially art on stage? And what does that mean? Can we reimagine it? Or are we maybe missing some irony or thinking too simply on some of these things? Well, The Taming of the Shrew is on stage at the Lyric Theater through April 15th. You heard them start the program talking about that, and that has us thinking about this. Taming of the Shrews is a production that has long been debated about themes, sexism, the empowerment of women, and more. And we're going to talk about that with some of the people in our studio this hour who have a lot to say on these matters. Virginia Monti is creator of the Walbrood Theater Company, and it's great to have you back here. How are you?
It's wonderful to be back.
How good was that intro? That was fun.
Oh my gosh. I don't know how we're following that up. I was over here just snickering.
I want you guys to do Driving Miss Daisy now.
Don't tempt us. We'll do it. No.
Scott O'Neill is a dramaturg, which for our audience who isn't as involved in the stage, what does that mean? What is a dramaturg?
I'm basically called on to be the resident nerd. So if there's a question about the book or the history or et cetera, I go find out the answer if I don't know it.
Well, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here, Scott. And Jamie Terrell is a local actor, director, researcher at the University of Rochester Medical Center, acted in some local Shakespeare productions. You directed Shrew, Taming of the Shrew once?
I directed The Taming of the Shrew in college. It was my thesis, so I spent a lot of time researching all of the possibilities before coming up with my own version.
And this is a little bit before the modern Me Too movement?
A little bit.
Okay, not that we're dating anybody, but I want to start by asking all of you, and I'll start with you, Jamie, just because of the amount of research and work you did. Taming of the Shrew has obviously a long history. It's been performed more times than anybody could possibly count. And the debate that is happening currently about the meaning and the themes, not just the word shrew, but the actions of the characters, is not necessarily new, is it?
It's been going since at least as long as we've had the play, because one of the artifacts that we have from the Elizabethan era is a sequel written by a friend of Shakespeare's called The Tamer Tamed. So clearly, back in the day, his original audience was questioning what was going on in the gender dynamics.
How interesting. Well, where can you see it? Let's Virginia Monty, what do we need? What does the audience need to know about the current production?
Well, you can find it at the Lyric Theater, and we run through April 15th. And in terms of what to know, this is an interesting. We actually went back to kind of the history of some of the stuff Shakespeare was referencing in terms of the comedy styling, so commedia and kind of that more physical slapstick. Because there's this wonderful quote, and I forget who says it, about comedy is pain. And I can't think of kind of a more painful subject right now. So this idea of really examining and digging into that in terms of gender archetype, in terms of the function of gender, both historically and in a contemporary setting. So,
and by the way, it's online if you want to get tickets now.
Yes.
LyricTheaterRochester.org or Walbird.org, bird with a Y. What is Walbird, by the way?
Walbird is actually a symbol for, it's the idea you get as an artist that kind of flutters in your chest and you don't quite have the phrasing or the means to say it. So you grab your brush, you grab your pen, you find another way to express it. So it's that little first instinct an artist gets when it comes time to create.
Walbird.com, by the way.
.com,
and also
yes.
at Wegmans if you want to get tickets
yes.
now.
Yes.
And what is your sort of broad take on Taming of the Shrew now in this moment, sort of reimagine is the wrong word. Maybe we're not reimagining anything here. Maybe we're just having a fresh conversation about the meaning. But how do you view that in light of these kind of conversations?
Yeah, no, it's one of the things that always struck me about Shrew, and the reason I was drawn to it is I think it has one of the funniest scenes ever written in English language ever, and it's the first meeting of Kate and Petruchio, and that scene just has some of the sexiest, the funniest, the fastest lines that have ever been kind of dealt with. And it always struck me as weird to have a show that predominantly focuses about the abuse of a woman as a comedy. Like, that really, there's not too much that I find funny about that. I don't think anyone finds that very funny. So there was a wonderful article written by The Guardian not too long ago that kind of examined that Shrew really has fallen into kind of two general camps now. People tend to either examine it as it exists today in the current context, or they tend to focus on kind of it as a love story. And it's kind of an imperfect love story in terms of two people trying to figure out how to love each other if they have no idea what that means or how to do that. And so our show kind of falls more into that camp. But that said, every single step of the way, because of this, the nature of the show, every rehearsal, every line has to be gone over with both understandings. And we talk, you know, I think the actors have talked ad nauseum in terms of what does gender mean to them? What does violence mean to them? Many of them have their own personal stories that involve kind of deep-seated pain around that. So in order to get to the root of what we wanted to do, we still had to go through that same mire and really examine it. And what we came up with was this kind of clowning world where we're looking at everything in kind of strict archetype. And it allows us to do more with it than I think, because it's outside the context of a kind of a contemporary setting, but it's still very aware of it. And there is kind of towards the end a nod to what's going on in that in terms of how we use gender today and how it's a little more fluid than what Shakespeare would have seen at the time.
By the way, this is how The Guardian decided to strip down the description of Taming of the Shrew in several short sentences. A man acquires a rich but headstrong woman as his bride. At the wedding, he punches the priest and later refuses to attend the family party. He drags his bewildered wife through the mud to his country house, where he starves her, deprives her of sleep, and contradicts every word she says. By the time they return to her father's home, the woman is meek and submissive.
That is one interpretation of the text, I think. Yes.
Is it yours?
No, actually. I think there's, obviously, that's kind of the plot points along it, but there's some kind of interesting factors that go into the, kind of the history of, particularly the word taming, that Shakespeare's audience would have understood. So, for example, when we think of taming, we also can think of like a dog or some other kind of domestic animal. But for Shakespeare's audience, oftentimes the image was for a hawk or some other bird. And with that, the way a bird is tamed, particularly a predatory bird, the owner or the trainer has to go through the exact same thing that the animal goes through. If the animal is not eating, you also have to not eat. If you don't let the animal sleep, you also have to not sleep. That's the only way you're going to get the respect of the animal. So there's kind of a double meaning that, again, Shakespeare's audience would have understood. And they use the word, you know, they reference Kate as a bird multiple times throughout the show. So there's this hidden joke that they would have heard in the reference of taming that we today no longer know. And so part of doing any show, I think, particularly, you know, our mission at Walbird is looking at what these plays mean to us today. So it's about re-illuminating things that would have been very natural for Shakespeare's audience that for us is either lost or doesn't have the same meaning or context.
Yeah, and this is where I want to turn to Scott O'Neill for a conversation about the way we look at history and sometimes apply modern values or standards, sometimes modern language and assumptions. And I think, you know, I'll give you one just recent example. We had a conversation with a couple who rewrote Baby, It's Cold Outside in sort of the light of the Me Too movement because they felt that the song was, in their words, kind of rapey. And I actually read a very interesting feminist and a true feminist defense of the original song from 1944, saying that, look, men were allowed to be promiscuous and women who wanted to be more sexually liberated were viewed in a different social context. And the song is more about that push-pull that they both want to stay, but she knows she's going to be judged unfairly.
I read the same article.
And I thought that was interesting. Now, I'm not endorsing any one particular take, but if we only use our modern understanding, look, there's certain things I'm not ever going to look back on, slavery and many other obvious examples that will never be okay. But how do we start to strike that balance of saying, here's how I understand it in 2018. Here's what it might have meant at the time. Here's what the customs of the time were. And start to kind of understand better, draw distinctions, et cetera. It's complicated.
It is, but I think you almost have to kind of approach drama that way, especially drama that's 400 years old, and that's a big part of the reason why Shakespeare is still as prevalent as he is right now. I mean, just looking at one example from the last 100 years or so, if you look at Henry V, Olivier's Henry V minimized what war looked like because he was doing it in 1944 at the height of World War II. And it was almost a propaganda piece. There was no blood. It was a perfect victory. And you go to 1989 with Kenneth Branagh's Henry V. You know, it's a much more jaded world. He's showing the grim, gory reality of war. He's slogging off the battlefield, carrying a dead Christian Bale over his shoulders. And so it's, you know, war even kills Batman. And so it's each film. It's the same play, the same words, but it's very much a creation of its time. And Shrew represents that as well. You look through, I mean, I jotted down some examples from different versions of the play. Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks have a very well-known version in 1929 where it was one of the first talkies. It was the first Shakespearean talkie, and that was the first wink. That was the first time in that final speech that Kate looked at her sister and winked as if to say, I don't believe any of this crap. I'm just going along with it to fool this moron who I'm married to. And that kind of became a tradition and a staple of performances of Taming of the Shrew.
Can I interrupt? Because I, having never seen it and looking forward to seeing it, is that now a staple? Is that expected? Is that wink part of how it's usually performed or no?
Well, it's getting to the point where people are even seeing the wink as old hat because it's been almost 100 years of winking. And so now you're seeing even different versions. The Folger Theater did a version where they played it up as a sort of a loving romance where they're both practical jokers. They're kind of torturing other people with this back and forth that they're doing. And when Kate enters the stage in the final scene, she sees the pile of money that they put down on the wager over whose wife would be, you know, the most submissive and docile, shares a look with Petruchio, her husband. They both immediately know what's going on, and they play the game in order to bilk the others out of their money. There's a modern version from Shakespeare retold from 2005 where Shirley Henderson, who listeners might know better as Moaning Myrtle from Harry Potter, played a British politician who married Petruchio not because she was forced to, but because he was a noble and that would suit her political ambitions. And so they were using each other. And so it's the idea of, and this is why it fits so well for the Me Too movement, because the idea of who's messing with whom and who's in control and whether this is a relationship that is going in both directions based on equality or one where one side is trying to dominate the other. You know, that's a question at the very center of the play, and it's a question you've got to figure out before you put on a production of the play. And as Jamie mentioned earlier, within a couple of years of, you know, The Taming of the Shrew, Fletcher put on a woman's prize, The Tamer Tamed. And Fletcher was Shakespeare's collaborator in Shakespeare's later career, where Petruchio is now a widower, marries a woman named Maria, who is having none of his taming. And she gets all the neighborhood women together to withhold sexual favors from their husbands until they win. And there are a lot of really hilarious scenes in that one. And so even going back, 400 years, people were still having those conversations about these characters in this world.
Okay, so certainly much more complex than what The Guardian distills it to, which probably happens often. But let me go back around the table, and I'll start with you then. Let's set a different scenario, though. Let's set a scenario in which historically it is, take Taming of the Shrew, and let's just create a universe in which it is clearly a sexist, the violence against women is played for laughs, that women are viewed as something to be tamed and owned, that there's not a wink in Kate's final scene, and that in modern terms, to use a word that's often used, it's viewed as problematic. Is it okay to say, I like a lot of the material, but I'm going to reimagine it. I'm going to insert a wink. I'm going to create, Kate has a political ambition and she's going to use Petruchio too, that it's going to be an equality of using each other. Or do you say, look, the source material is the source material, and if there's texture to it, then we can reinterpret. But if it's pretty clear, I'm not comfortable with touching it or massaging it in different ways. How do you feel about that?
I think it's definitely okay to reimagine something like that, especially something where so much of the play does have modern resonance. Because one of the interesting things about the character of Kate is, while in the 1590s, the pre-taming version of her persona might have been seen as, shrewish or problematic, that's very much in line with what is seen as sort of an ideal feminist kind of take on the Me Too movement. She's putting up with no one's abuse. She's putting up with, no one speaking against her or treating her badly. I taught high school before going to graduate school, and I taught this play, and I had a very shy young lady in my class who was keeping an audio journal, and Kate was her hero until that final speech, and she was just crushed. And it was a very powerful moment and opened up a lot of great conversations for the student. And so it's, drama's not always about showing what's neat and tidy. It's about opening up conversations and opening up situations where people can feel something. And Taming of the Shrew is one of those plays where you can take it in a lot of different directions, and each direction you take it opens up new things for people to feel.
Virginia, do you have a comfort level with saying, look, in 2018, we're doing this, but we're going to massage it in a little bit of a different direction here? Or do you think you have to at least adhere to some of the original intent?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's, you just hit on it. To me, it's about original intent, which is, what was Shakespeare trying to write? And when I walked into this project, the first thing I thought is, well, I know he wanted a comedy. So if that's what we're trying to translate to a modern audience, we have to look at what today is funny and, what of this can be illuminated in such a way to make it funny. And I think one of my favorite moments was the woman playing Kate had this moment early on where she kind of turned to me. She said, I don't want a pretty Kate. I want a Kate who can be equally as ugly as Petruchio, who can be equally nasty and equally all of these things. And to her, that's a form of liberation. And that's what she wanted to focus on. And I think it's created this very kind of work. Because Kate, as much as she's, quote, abused, she also is an abuser in the early parts of the play. They talk about how she's perfect in every way except she's a shrew, except that she is abusive to the people around her. And she really wanted to experiment with that. And I think she's come up with kind of a nice answer to that. But I guess to get back to your question, I think it depends on what you want the text to do. For me and for my money, I want modern audience to see what Shakespeare's audiences, or what he was trying to illuminate for them. And in this context, I think it is the comedy. It's his first kind of experiment with commedia as a styling. There actually is references to commedia characters throughout the play. And, commedia is an Italian tradition. So here you have this English writer trying to make way or trying to do something with this kind of a deeply Italian concept and playing around with it. He's also playing around with kind of the concept of comedy. Comedy in the most traditional setting is kind of ends with a wedding. And here you have a play that has a wedding and keeps going, has a wedding and keeps going. Like, there's something about that fact that he never is satisfied with just seeing what, quote, the happy ending is, but wants to play past that. So that's another place we wanted to experiment. So it's just what is it that you want to illuminate in any particular production? And what's great about Shakespeare is he wrote about humans, which means it's very adaptable to any conversation. And I think that's why this play has such a longevity, be it to examine kind of the nature of the abuse of the feminine, or to examine just the comedy of falling in love for the first time and not knowing what to do.
And I'm glad you mentioned the prominence of Italian tradition and culture, because one of the other kind of avenues that's explored in this play is issues of nationalism and you know the superiority of culture, because it is a play set in Italy and most of the characters are very Italian in nature. You've got Hortensio, Petruchio, Gremio, and the country house that Petruchio takes Kate to. First off, he insists on calling her Kate as opposed to Caterina. And so he gives the anglicized version of her name. And then when he gets to his country house, suddenly the names change. His servants are not carrying Italian names. His servants are named Curtis, Nathaniel, Philip, Joseph, Nicholas, and Peter. And so he absconds with Kate basically to his country house, and the country of the house is essentially England. And so England sort of, you know, creates this change that she then brings back to Italy. And so it's a weird commentary on national culture and identity as well.
This panel is so above my head. I'm loving this conversation. I'm just loving it. Jamie, how do you feel about the idea of sort of interpreting and maybe seeing something that's ambiguous, but understanding changing cultures in modern times and massaging material to fit either a message and an important idea, or to maybe avoid some of the more problematic ideas that might have been there in the past?
Well, there's a whole component to the play that we haven't talked about yet, which is that Shakespeare wrote it as a play within a play. So the story of Kate and Petruchio's relationship is presented by actors. And in the Elizabethan theater, they would have been all male actors on the stage. So this exploration of gender dynamics is played exclusively by men, defining what the relationships between men and women ought to be, as they seem to be claiming. But it is intentionally fictionalized and brought to the audience's attention that the picture that they're painting is fictional, which then, I believe, encourages the audience to think critically about what gender dynamics are supposed to be and who should be part of that conversation. There are moments in the play where people observe things from a distance and then describe a completely different reality from what has happened or what they've observed. And so that questioning what you're seeing is a level of uncertainty that Shakespeare places that I think allows us to accept uncertainty and massaging of reality into any interpretation of the play, because it's inherently there in the original text. So now when women get to speak the words about women being inferior to men, they have been given the gift of uncertainty by the way Shakespeare crafted the scene and the play as a whole.
Perhaps just more of a evidence of Shakespeare, whoever he or they were. The whole audience.
I bleed.
Scott's going, we're not going to do that, are we? No, we're not. Scott, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. That's a whole,
He was holding the mirror as 'twere up to nature, as he says in Hamlet, and using theater as an opportunity for us to examine our reality. And that's an inherent component of the way Shrew is structured as well.
I want to get to a listener named Beth's question, who emails, I think, an interesting question. I think our guests are going to have an interesting take on it. I'll get to that in a second. But what they're describing, as we talk about Taming of the Shrew and the era of Me Too, which is, by the way, showing at the Lyric Theater, which is on East Avenue, and you can get tickets now, lyrictheaterrochester.org or walbird.com or at Wegmans, showing through April 15th. There is no ambiguity. Nobody 400 years from now is going to look at 16 Candles and say, hey, you remember that scene where the jock is dating this girl and the dorky guy is interested in this girl, and the jock says, hey, thanks for helping me find this other girl I like. Here are the keys to my car. My girlfriend is so passed out drunk that you may take her for the night and do whatever you like with her. And that scene, which is essentially condoning rape, is played for laughs. No one 400 years from now is going to say, you know, that was actually John Hughes being really subversive and no, it was just just out of bounds. It's just a mess. But Shakespeare apparently was more textured, more layered with Taming of the Shrew that gave much more of an opportunity for interpretation, which is why I thought this email was interesting from Beth. She wants to know, do your guests think Shakespeare was a feminist? Now, feminist would have meant something entirely different in Shakespeare's time, but what do you think?
I certainly believe he valued human beings, and for having a troupe of actors that was comprised entirely of men, that he came up with so many nuanced and intriguing female roles for them to play shows a deep appreciation for women and the journeys that they go through in life. So I'll say I believe Shakespeare is a feminist.
Okay, Virginia?
I think you took it right out of my mouth. You know, it's one of the things I love about Shakespeare is he, you know, the women are just as much villain, just as much lover. Just, you know, they're just as passionate, just as big on stage as many of the male counterparts. So I'm very, yeah, I think he saw in women just as much humanity as he saw in anybody. You know, that's kind of what makes it still work today.
Hmm. Scott?
I agree with a lot of that. I think some of the telling element would be that the way that Renaissance society treated quote unquote shrews was significantly harsher than anything Shakespeare showed. There was literally a judicial device called a scold's bridle, which was sort of a headpiece with a metal part that would go over top of a woman's tongue to prevent her from speaking, that could literally break a jaw. And these were ubiquitous. They were used as a threat for women who were speaking out of turn. And Shakespeare treated that the idea of how to approach, you know, the quote unquote problem of shrewishness in a much different way. But at the same time, there is still an element of misogyny in here. What Shakespeare does that I think is interesting is he points out a lot of the hypocrisy on the masculine side. And so it's, you know, the conduct manuals of the time were very big on how women should behave. And in a lot of ways, Kate lives up to every element of those conduct manuals, while her sister, Bianca, does everything in violation of them. And every man in that town, except for Petruchio, rejects Kate and wants Bianca. And so part of the interest of the play is you've got a Renaissance ideal woman and the exact opposite, and none of the men want the ideal woman as defined by themselves.
Well, now I see the phone starting to ring, and I've got more emails to get through. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking about Taming of the Shrew, and we're also talking about the way we interpret classic theater, great writing and performance and the meaning that perhaps in the lens of the modern era looks a little bit different. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. One of our listeners wants to know, are there any shows, any plays your guests will not do? They'll put a foot down on. We'll ask about that in our second half hour. And we're going to get into some other things. Elizabeth on Twitter says, I think a number of Shakespeare's women are of interest to the current climate. How would Lady Macbeth or Tamora from Titus Andronicus respond to shifting understandings of gender and power? So that's an interesting question and idea there. And Gary is on the line in Greece. We're going to take his call when we come back. More of your comments and questions as well with our guest Virginia Monti, who is the creator of the Wallbird Theater Company. Scott O'Neill, a dramaturg who is providing great historical context for us this hour. That's what he does. And Jamie Terrell, local actor, director, and researcher at the University of Rochester Medical Center. You can see Taming of the Shrew at the Lyric now. Through April 15th. Get online at lyrictheaterrochester.org or wallbird.com. We're coming right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, a new film called Chappaquiddick revisits the story of Ted Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne. And the director is from the Rochester area. John Curran joins us in studio to talk about his film and what he hopes it will accomplish. In our second hour, how doctors talk to patients and how they can do it more effectively. If you have ideas on that, share them with us Tuesday on Connections. All right, welcome back to Connections. Gary, I'm going to get you in a second, but Scott O'Neill said something during the break that I think is an interesting sort of comparison with Kate and Petruchio from Taming of the Shrew. Who is one of the modern analogs, you think?
Well, I've recently on Netflix been watching Cheers, and Kate and Petruchio in a lot of ways are very similar to Sam and Diane, where there's that sort of that connection, but they're sort of, you know, abusing each other. Sam has the social upper hand, the financial upper hand. And so there, if you rewatch Cheers now, the vast majority of it is still very funny, but there are moments where it gets very uncomfortable. There's one where Sam and Diane are arguing and she slaps him and he slaps her back and they end up making out on the floor of the bar. And Taming of the Shrew opens in a bar where the guy gets thrown out because he can't pay his bill and he gets drunk, and that's the beginning of the play within the play. But it's that even back in the 80s, there are these elements where you've got a relationship that is interesting and funny, but in a modern context is also problematic in a lot of ways.
And I want to call back to the wonderful intro that Megan Mack and Juan Vazquez did for us, which I think was actually meant to do two things. Number one is to make fun of ourselves a little bit for being a little too ready to find offense in everywhere we turn, but also to say there are going to be times where it's legitimate, I think, to look back and if we're uncomfortable, ask why. And I think it's a good thing that standards change. That doesn't mean that we never do art, that we never do shows, but one of our listeners wanted to know if there are shows that you just won't do. Are there any plays that just, Virginia, anything come to mind where that's just too much? I can't feel good about it.
I mean, for me, those are the plays I'm drawn to because that's where the question is what does that mean today? You know, a few years ago, we did Duchess of Malfi, which is an incredibly violent story against women. I mean, they are brutalized on stage. And I think we're partly drawn to that because that is kind of a Me Too movement talking point in terms of a woman in power who her own family won't let that happen. So, you know, we wanted to talk about that because that did feel relevant. So I don't know. There's nothing immediately that jumps to mind. And that's like, oh, that's clearly untouchable. In fact, that's usually the material I personally find intriguing because then there's a question of what is this? And that's, to me, the rehearsal process is going, what is this? How is this now? What can we do with it now?
Mm-hmm. Jamie, anything that stands out to you?
I was thinking about this question recently, and a play that came to mind was one I read in college, which the title is actually, if you know the word I'm going to use, it is offensive, and that is the point. That's why I bring it up, but most people have probably not heard it, which the play is called The Octoroon, which means someone with 1/8 Negro blood. It was written, I forget how many hundred years ago, but in an era where racial identity was completely different than we understand it now. And I was thinking, well, that feels untouchable. It certainly feels untouchable to me because I don't have a message to convey about race that I would feel justified in taking that on. And then in the last week, I saw that the Royal Shakespeare Company has it in their upcoming season.
Ooh.
So I think there's power that some of these classic plays with uncomfortable themes have to get us to recognize the challenges. So if it's handled correctly, which I certainly hope and have high expectations that the Royal Shakespeare Company would handle this challenge correctly, it leads to growth and learning opportunities.
Okay, sure, fair. I mean, I had lunch with a couple of friends, a gay couple recently, and I was saying, boy, you know, Seinfeld, you go back and watch Seinfeld, and it's really homophobic. And they said, oh, you didn't notice that the first time through, huh? They said, well, we see homophobia in a lot of places, especially in popular culture.
Friends.
Just homophobia everywhere. And I think it is a good thing not to be comfortable with it, to re-examine and to what that means. I think there's something healthy about that. I don't think there's something overly policing about that. Now, I think anything can go too far, but there's a scene where Elaine's on the subway and she's going to a lesbian wedding and she tells the woman says, where are you going? She says, a lesbian wedding. And by the way, just saying lesbian wedding, they play the laugh track. That's supposed to be funny. You know, like, I don't know why that certainly wouldn't be a laugh track line today. But then the woman on the subway says, well, you know, 25 years on the subway, I never talked to anybody. And the first person I talked to is going to a lesbian wedding. And she stomps away and it's a laugh track line. I'm not comfortable with that. And I'm glad that I don't feel good about that. But I think that's how things have changed. I think that in many ways is a healthy thing that changes. So, Gary, thanks for hanging in there. I'm coming to you in 1 second, but I guess where I'm saying, I'm going back to your Cheers thing, and I'm thinking about those uncomfortable scenes. Doesn't mean I'm never going to watch Seinfeld again, but there are times where I think, I don't know why that was funny a generation ago, and I'm glad it's not anymore.
And it's not the text, it's not the topic, it's what you do with it. So it's, I was trying to think of a play that would be right off the bat off limits to me, and I couldn't, but I could think of performance practices. Like, as recently as 1990, it was acceptable for Othello to be played by a white man in blackface, and I wouldn't even consider, I wouldn't go see it, I wouldn't support it. That would be something that would be completely offensive.
Yeah, obviously. That's a great point. And by the way, this is what that clip I was just referring to sounded like.
What does he do, if you don't mind my asking? She works, he doesn't. He sounds like my son.
There is no he.
There's no he? So, who's getting married?
Two women. It's a lesbian wedding. Soul on the subway for 35 years. I get the best man at a lesbian wedding.
So it's just, Jamie, you're looking at me like, I can't even believe that's a laugh track line.
Yeah.
Doesn't that, it just feels like it's a different planet coming, you know, and that's a classic American show. And the way I feel is, I'm glad that we don't see that anymore. And I don't think we should feel badly that standards change. So whether we're reexamining Seinfeld or Taming with the Shrew or anything else, that should be probably part of the conversation. But Gary wants to jump in on Taming of the Shrew, or at least Shakespeare and feminism. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, Evan, it's good to have you back.
That's nice. Although to be back.
But the crew did a pretty good job while you were gone.
Pretty good. Gary, I listened from Spain, which just shows you how sick I am, and they did an amazing job. There's a number of people who are actually not so thrilled I'm back, but go ahead.
It was amazing. Well, first of all, on feminism, actually, to go back to a comment one of your guests just made. I mean, isn't the mission one of the purposes of art to challenge us? And in regards to feminism, it was brought up about Lady Macbeth, but I also think you could look at Romeo and Juliet. I mean, Juliet was in no way conforming with tradition and expectations, and we see the tragic end when people are expected to do that. But the point I really wanted to talk about is the final scene and the essence of the relationship in Taming of the Shrew. And that has always been one of my favorite plays. And I think sometimes people are missing the point. And maybe it's just my interpretation. But what I see at the end is, and one of my favorite versions is the movie version with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor because they're such great actors. But at the end, when Kate brings the other women in and she kneels and offers her hand, and she said, you know, let this be a comfort for his boot. But he doesn't put his boot on her hand. What he does is he offers her hand and lifts her up. And isn't that the beauty of a real relationship? That you have two people that are lifting each other up and really bringing out the best in each other? And I think that's where the real romance in that comes in. And I think sometimes that when people get upset about that final speech, that they really need to pay attention to that very last moment when they lift each other up, they bring out the best in each other, and they're equals. Thanks, Evan.
Gary, thanks for the phone call. Let's go around the table. Virginia Monty, what do you think?
I think that is an excellent point. In fact, that one section to me was the first real big breakthrough I had, I think, understanding, because I was really meditating on that last, you know, put your hands down below for your husband to step upon. And I realized Shakespeare is a master of metaphor, and he did a double meaning line. That line could be seen one of two ways, and I think he did this intentionally. One is get below your husband to step upon, or if you look at the rest of the context of the play and even the rest of that speech, which Kate is kind of implying in many ways is women look what you're capable of. Women look what you can do. Women take pity on your husbands, put your hand down there where they are and pull them up. Because they're better than this. And it ties to the fact that, in fact, a lot of people don't know this, the word shrew, the first time it is used in the play, actually, at least in the storytelling element, the first time it is used, it's actually not used for Kate. It is used for Petruchio. So there is potentially a double meaning in the nature of even the title of the play, Taming of the Shrew. And that line is, you know, by all account, he is more shrew than she. And there is some question in terms of who is the shrew of the tale, and this idea that Kate has just as much power to bring him to a better state of being, one where he's more conscious, more aware, more loving, because he changes too, and a lot of people forget that. He's not the same person in the beginning as he is in the end.
Jamie, how did you feel about that phone call?
Well, I think Gary captured part of the dynamic that when I produced Taming of the Shrew is what I aimed for was showcasing that it is a meeting of equals in the relationship of Kate and Petruchio. And in that scene, it's their opportunity to show that off to the crowd gathered at the wedding celebration and show that their collaborative defiance of society forms the strongest team of the marriages that are on display in the final scene.
Scott?
I think Gary really summed up what the modern interpretation of Shrew has been, that it makes it a narrative that people are comfortable with and makes it so they can enjoy it. The line about putting her hand beneath her husband's foot, that actually pulls from ceremonial sort of wedding traditions of the time, where women went from a state of being under the control of the father to being under the control of the husband, and the husband brings, it's not to step on her hand, it's to reach down and bring her up as her new position as her his wife rather than her father's daughter. And in the modern, the Shirley Henderson, the Shakespeare retold, where it was she was playing the politician, she delivers that speech and she says, she's like, I would do this if he asked me, but he won't. And he would do it if I asked him, but I won't, because we respect each other enough not to do that. And so it's that line that was sort of initially a reference to a marriage rite is sort of now being reinterpreted to be a conversation between equals, which I think is a really wonderful development in terms of the way the play works.
See, someone could hear your response to Gary's call and take that to mean, when you say Gary has summed up some of the modern interpretation that is a little more comfortable, is rationalizing a play that maybe didn't mean that. But I don't think that's what you're saying. I think what I'm hearing all of our panelists say is that this is part of the brilliance of Shakespeare. Part of the brilliance of a play like The Taming of the Shrew is it gives you those layers and it gives you sort of that opportunity. But what do you think? Do you think Shakespeare himself would be okay with Gary's phone call?
We were Twitter friends, Shakespeare and I.
Yeah, I know. But you never want to speak for the bard.
It's tough because, you know, we know, comparatively speaking, very, very, very little about Shakespeare. Most of what we do know is sort of second and third hand from what other people have written, people that complained
Edward
about him.
Edward de Vere traveled a lot, went to Italy.
And then he was a teacher for a while,
I'm
and then he went
tweaking.
To the moon. And
I'm just poking the bear. I'm just poking because we're going to argue about. No, we're not going to argue. We're not going to do that.
No, because the bear is fast and he can pursue. But no, it's the kind of thing where Shakespeare changes. That's what makes Shakespeare so great. There's, you know, we can speculate based on historical context what the play might have, what each play might have meant in the 1590s, 1600 through 1616. But what the reason Shakespeare is still here is because in the 17th century they did different things with it. In the 18th century, they did different things. They did different things with it. In the 19th century, they went completely insane and worshipped it. And then in the 20th century, film opened up a whole lot of other possible interpretations. And so it's what makes Shakespeare great is the fact that every generation for the last 400 years has made those words their own. And that's what makes it brilliant.
Yeah, remarkable stuff from our guests here. We're talking about not just Taming of the Shrew, but also the way we imagine and reimagine classic works for the stage. And you can see Taming of the Shrew through April 15th at the Lyric Theater on East Avenue. Tickets are $18 at lyrictheaterrochester.org or wallbird.com, BYRD. You can also find them at Wegmans. You heard Scott O'Neill, who's a dramaturg with us this hour, Virginia Monti, who's the creator of the Wallbird Theater Company, and Jamie Terrell, a local actor, director, and researcher at the University of Rochester Medical Center. I mentioned on Twitter, and let's get Elizabeth's comment. She says, I think a number of Shakespeare's women are of interest in the current conversation. Lady Macbeth, Tamora, how would they respond to shifting understandings of gender and power? What do you think?
I think it's a really interesting question, and as we have auditions coming up for the Rochester Community Players and Wallbird are collaborating on Two Gentlemen of Verona, which also could trigger some interesting Me Too conversations if you want us back in a few weeks. But it's a play that is written with three female characters, and the rest of the characters are male because that's what happens in Shakespeare's company. And we always are have many more women show up than we have roles to offer. Many more wonderfully talented women show up than we have roles to offer them. And when you take it apart and look for opportunities to give more female actors opportunities to get involved, it becomes challenging because Shakespeare wrote so few and yet so engaging females. He's crafted a gendered world around them where once you start changing the dynamics of the world as a whole, the whole power structure has the potential to fall apart. And so you have to put a lot of thought into, are we asking women to play men? Are we asking a character to change gender, and what does that do in the world of that particular story? Because if Tamara is the one of two women in that world, and she is conspiring to have her sons rape the other female character in that play, we're talking about Titus Andronicus, for those who don't know it, Shakespeare's bloodiest play, it changes the dynamic when there are women involved. In the recent DVC production at Muck in December, one of those sons was played by a woman. And suddenly you have a different power hierarchy in place when the conspirators are different genders than the characters that they play.
Hmm. Virginia.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that, to me, is most interesting, because I study a lot of mythological structure and archetype, which is a wonderful help for kind of dissecting Shakespeare. Gender as archetype is an important function, and it kind of hits on, you know, that idea of being kind of entrapped in either a masculine or feminine world. You know, the fact that Lady M, your introduction to this character, and we just did this show, and, you know, the introduction to this character is her saying, "Unsex me here. Relieve me of my feminine qualities so that I might do what is needed." And to them, that, you know, archetype for them was a very real thing. These features were not just kind of stereotypes. These were embodied or embedded in what it was to be woman or to be man. And, you know, when we did Mac, we did have a female Macduff, and we had to look very long and hard to try to define in this world, how do we include that and still make it work with the nature of the plot? How do we still make it a masculine environment? So yeah, so it's to kind of get back to the heart of the question. One thing that always interests me is you have these wonderful female characters entrapped in masculine environments, and then what does that do? What does that mean? And, you know, you talk about a Me Too movement. That to me is kind of when you have these powerful figures either fighting for that structure. That's where you start to see some parallels for what's going on today.
Okay, Scott.
And I think it's a great question, and it goes to the heart of that whole idea that Shakespeare changes, because there are some great female characters that I'm not sure offhand who said it, but the idea that they're trapped in the masculine world was a great comment, and people have been experimenting with that for quite a long time. Lady Macbeth has sort of gone from being a corrupting influence on her husband in earlier productions to being part of, you know, one half of a very loving relationship where she believes that her husband should have this power. But you look at other plays where people have been trying to find more space for actresses, like The Tempest, that only has Miranda as the only female character. You know, Ariel has been cast frequently historically as a woman because, you know, directors looked for a male character that had quote unquote feminine traits. And now you're seeing, you know, looking at Shakespeare and Me Too, you're seeing a shift in that. Virginia's production of Macbeth was a great example. Macduff, there's very little that could be identified as stereotypically 1950s feminine in Macduff. But that actress just knocked it out of the park, did an amazing job with that role. And Dame Harriet Walter recently starred in three productions of Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, First Henry IV, and The Tempest, where it had an all-female cast. It was set in a women's prison. They were all set in a women's prison. And so Phillida Lloyd directed all three. Dame Harriet Walter starred. And they were absolutely phenomenal because they were playing the idea of the character rather than the gender of the character. And it opened up lots of interesting ways to look at it.
Well, Virginia, we're down to about just over our last minute here. The draw to come see Shakespeare is always just Shakespeare for starters. But for something that has been produced so many times over the centuries, I want to know what you hope that the audience does get out of this production of Taming of the Shrew.
This production is, I've really enjoyed it. I just have a marvelous cast, but it's very much a dreamscape, and it's fun, and it's energetic, and it's slapstick, and it's kind of just a great way to introduce yourself to Shakespeare.
I heard the music, but I think we're a minute early there. So you didn't have to. Okay, so let me just follow up with you there. For people who haven't seen it, is it almost more rewarding to come in having never seen Taming the Shrew now, or are you excited for people who have seen it in different productions?
Both. This one is very accessible. We designed it in many ways to be an access point to someone who maybe doesn't think they do know Shakespeare. It's very, without changing any of the language, it's particularly for young audiences. It's a very friendly interpretation for that regard. It's a lot of fun. The actors, we have actors who can do the kind of stunt work that you just don't get to see very often in Rochester. So the level of slapstick and acrobatics, and just, it's a high energy show, fast paced show, a lot of glitter, a lot of sparkle, but it has a heart at the bottom of it, which is really fun.
Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation this hour, and we always do when we have people like Virginia Monti, Scott O'Neill, Jamie Terrell in studio with us, talking about not just one single production, but some broad themes that apply in so many different directions. And I just want to thank all of you, and want to let our listeners know, lyrictheaterrochester.org or wallbird.com, wallbyrd.com. You can also get tickets at Wegmans, showing through Sunday, April 15th at the Lyric. Thanks to all of you for being here. Great stuff this hour. Thank you very much. Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, and Juan Vazquez, our colleague. Wonderful introduction to the hour, and wonderful work as always. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.